Vous êtes à l'écoute de
Mosaic.
Hey everybody, it's Anna, and you're listening to Mosaic, a podcast that explores how immigration shapes identity. I grew up without a lot of religion in my life. My family is technically Catholic on both sides, but outside of weddings and funerals, I can count the number of times I've been to church on one hand. In middle school, I went to a lot of bar and bat mitzvahs, but the religious ceremonies were always just something to get through before the cake and the DJs came out. The United States is a secular Christian society, so it's easy, if you're part of the majority, to grow up like I did. Inherit the religion of your parents, celebrate major holidays, attend some services, but not really live the religion. But if you're part of a less represented faith, like Islam, it takes much more of a conscious effort to maintain your religion. For one Muslim family in Massachusetts, belonging to a religious minority has made them more devout.
When I came to the United States, I felt, okay, this country gave me the space to do what I was planning for me to be.
In this episode of Mosaic, Amjad Kinjawi and Maize Bajbouj Kinjawi let me into their home to break fast during Ramadan and to learn how living as Muslims in the United States has allowed them to become both more Muslim and more American.
Here is everyone.
Hey, everyone.
Hi. You're seeing the place when everybody is locked in, so.
It's beautiful. It's a beautiful home.
Thank you. This is Amjad.
Hi, Amjad.
Maize is holding up her laptop and showing a video call of me to the rest of her family. It's April 23rd. The second night of Ramadan, and about a month into coronavirus lockdown. Maize's husband, Amjad, is joking that their living room isn't usually so chaotic. But when you have two kids home all day doing remote learning, things get a little messy.
This is Lujain.
Hi, Lujain.
And this is Zaid.
Hi, Zaid.
Maize and Amjad are working from home, too. Maize is a professor of Arabic and French language in Boston and Rhode Island, and Amjad owns his own dental practice in North Attleboro. While Maize is finishing up her semester via Zoom, Amjad is taking phone calls from patients. Social distancing has not only changed the way we all work, but it's affected how people worship.
We used to hold mass iftar, like a lot of people come together to break the fast together, which are now a little bit less possible.
Both Maize and Amjad are active members of the Rhode Island Islamic Society, which has its masjid, or mosque, in Pawtucket. Since coronavirus hit, its doors have been closed, even during Ramadan. Normally during this month, Muslims head to the mosque to pray after breaking their daily fast with a huge gathering of friends and family called an iftar. But this year, even the iftars have changed. The change isn't totally negative, though. Since the mosques are closed, Amjad is leading his family in their daily prayers instead of an imam. And each night, he guides his children through their readings of the Quran.
For me, this Ramadan is the first Ramadan that I'm really enjoying it. Really. Because we are home.
Quarantine!
To be a devout Muslim requires a lot of scheduling. There are 5 daily prayers to be done at specific times of the day. And during Ramadan, those prayers are even more essential and weighted. You can imagine, if you're working a full-time job, having to figure out when to schedule prayer breaks throughout the day, and then coming home and having to do that with young kids, and then traveling to the mosque, it's a lot. Coronavirus has simplified things.
So really this time, I'm really enjoying it. And especially like, it's been a while since I had my kids. I do not go to the mosque because I don't want to bother people with a baby crying or someone wants to sleep. So I stay home and I pray by myself. But now, since I have him with me,
we pray all together.
We are praying together. So probably he's missing the mosque. But me, I have him with me. So I have the same benefits. I'm really happy.
And I'm happy too, because the pandemic has made video chatting a way of life. So I'm able to virtually sit at the table with the Kenjawi family and break fast with them throughout Ramadan without having to leave my home.
So do you really fast the day that you meet with us or just by...
No, I really fast.
Oh, yeah. You really fast.
Okay. Yeah. I've been really fasting. Well, not every, only the days I meet with you, but yeah. Not, yeah. But yeah, I feel like disingenuous to not.
Questions.
Let's meet a little bit more often. That's going to kill you, huh?
I'm not going to die, but fasting is tough. Again, I grew up without really any religious commitments. So the idea of fasting every day for the 29 days of Ramadan got me asking a lot of questions. Like, why? And then how? And finally, could I actually do it? I figured the only way to understand is to experience it. So whenever I met with the Kenjawis for iftar, I abstained from food and water from sun up until sundown. And in my talks with Amjad before breaking the fast together, he answers a lot of my questions.
And that's the purpose of the fasting. So you might achieve piety. When you look at what the fasting is supposed to teach us or to make of us, you find that it's just purification of the human soul into a better one. You need to be kinder to people. You need to think of your neighbors. You need to think of those. You might be fasting by choice, but there's people who are fasting because they don't really have the means to not fast.
Fasting also ties Muslims into a centuries-old tradition and worldwide Islamic community. Growing up in Syria, fasting during Ramadan is one of Amjad's few acts of piety.
Friday prayer, for example, it's a must. Fasting Ramadan is a must. I used to slack in other things. Sometimes I say that I learned Islam when I came to the state.
Amjad's family is Muslim, and his parents teach their kids about Islam, but Amjad does not have a deep spiritual connection to the religion. He's more into education and becoming a dentist. He attends university and dental school in Damascus. Then he travels to France to learn more advanced practices and bring those back to Syria. But along the way, he takes a trip to the United States that makes him question going back to his home country to practice dentistry.
And I did like the system. I did like how dentistry is being presented in the state. So I said, you know what? Maybe that's where I want, because I love what I do and I want it to be done in the best possible ways.
So Amjad decides to go to dental school for the third and final time in the U.S. He gets a student visa and arrives in Boston in 1993 to attend Boston University. By the end of the decade, he's working at a private dental practice in the suburbs of Boston and applying to become a full-blown American citizen. He's still more focused on his career and dental practice than his religion, but that's about to change.
We have unconfirmed reports this morning that a plane has crashed into one of the towers of the World Trade Center.
And the people who knocked these buildings down will hear all of us soon.
The Islamic terror threat in America.
The problem is the ideology.
You know, this is also a war on Islam.
September 11th, 2001 shocks the world, and it puts a spotlight on Muslims everywhere. Amjad is in North Attleboro at the time of the attacks. He had just become a partner at a private dental practice the year before. He remembers feeling just as horrified as everybody else. But soon, that horror shifts into a defense of his religion in the face of ignorance.
That is not Islam. That is something where sometimes the media can go a little wrong by exposing the negative, even though it does not present the true religion, and say, okay, this is what it is. This is who we are dealing with. All Muslims are like this. Again, I'm not gonna be ashamed of fanatic or somebody who's crazy who would like to, in the name of Islam, do something evil. This person is not associated with my religion, so I don't even know why I should be ashamed of him.
Amjad is in the process of getting his citizenship at this time. His final interview is just weeks after 9/11.
I actually, to be honest with you, I was concerned because of what happened and how, like, those Muslims, the terrorists that are attacking the United States and everything else. So I was concerned about my interview and my time with the officer.
But Amjad says his interviewer that day was more concerned about the fact that he had to share an office with somebody else. He spent half the interview just complaining to Amjad.
So I just sat there and listened to him, and we did not discuss anything about 9/11 or anything of this nature. Did not want to know anything about that. So it was an easy interview.
Amjad becomes a U.S. citizen. And with this commitment to a new country, he also finds a renewed commitment to Islam. He's been attending Friday prayers at the masjid in Pawtucket, but for the first time, he asks if he can get involved with the Muslim society run out of the mosque. He forms a close relationship with the imam, and soon, he joins the board of the society. Amjad helps raise funds for the Islamic Day School in Rhode Island, and he joins the board of the Rhode Island Council for Muslim Advancement. On the other side of the Atlantic, Mays has just moved to Paris. Even before 9/11, France is a hard place to be openly Muslim. The country's constitutional right of laïcité, or secularism, has made it possible for the country to ban all conspicuous religious symbols in public places. Critics of the policies say they discriminate against Muslim immigrant women, like Mays, who might choose to wear head coverings on a daily basis. At the time of the attacks, though, Mays does not wear any hijab like she does today.
I born in Algeria. I had a life in Algeria. I came to Syria for a while. I went to France. So my life is always in change. And may Allah forgive my parents. They didn't teach me the religion. So I start teaching myself. I start looking around me and why this is happening. So I tried to teach myself and to know about Islam more.
After 9/11, France erupts into rallies and protests against hijabs. It creates a hostile environment for Muslims, especially covered women. Mays is surrounded by this tension. And just as she's planning a trip to the United States to visit friends on holiday, she makes a life-changing decision.
Ramadan came and I had the moment for me because I was ready to put my hijab. And as I said to put it and I put my hijab, and one of my friends just said to me, Mays, you're crazy. You should do the visa first before your hijab. And now with your hijab, no one is gonna accept you. And I said to her, you know, I don't believe that. Because if you do something truly for God, and if God has a plan for you to go to the United States, I'm gonna have the visa. It doesn't matter the hijab or not. I went to the interview, and I do remember I was in the room. There were a couple of people that are denied, and I'm only one with the hijab. I was accepted. Time I thought, when you do truly something to your God, like you're not pleasing anyone, you are pleasing Him, only Him. So why He's gonna reject it you? Why He's gonna say no? You're not gonna have this.
And it was meant to be.
Yeah.
When Mays gets to the U.S., her friends introduce her to Amjad. They click immediately, both with their Syrian backgrounds and newfound commitment to Islam. Months later, Amjad travels to Syria to meet Mays' family and ask her to marry him. They travel back to the U.S. together before their wedding.
I remember bring her from the airport to a...
It was the 4th of July.
It was the 4th of July, I believe. So there were like the fireworks, and I told her that I made those just for her, so...
And you believe him?
I'm kidding.
After getting married in 2003, Mays remains in Paris, finishing her PhD. She and Amjad alternate visiting each other every couple months. And they do this for 6 years, until...
I came here for good in 2009, when I was pregnant with Lujane.
Mays gives birth to Lujane in North Attleboro. And soon after, Mays begins to get work at local universities. One of her first jobs is a professor position at Boston College, a largely white Jesuit school in a wealthy suburb of Boston. She's the only covered woman on campus.
After 2 years, it was for me a first time seeing a covered woman inside the building, like inside the campus. when you go in, of course, there's people that they're gonna look at you saying, oh, she's Muslim.
As a professor wearing a hijab, Mayes sticks out. She never feels unsafe on campus, but she does feel like she has to explain herself all the time.
I know by my hijab, I have so many questions from people. Why you put the hijab? Why this is like this? And I guess I didn't have to talk about my religion, but the manners that you are presenting as a Muslim and how you are dealing with your students, how you are dealing with your colleagues, these shows what is the Islam. So we don't have always to defend ourselves, but by acting is the way that you can show people who we are, and we are human beings like others.
And this is the way that both Mayes and Amjad go through their lives. They don't preach their religion to others. They are their religion. They live it. And they let people make their own decisions about what Islam is, based on their actions.
If we're sitting here.
Yes.
Hey, Mayes.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good.
Good.
Yeah, she's here. She came to us.
No.
It's May 2nd now, the second week of Ramadan 2020. Mayes positions her laptop at the end of their kitchen table to show Amjad, Lujain, and Zaid getting ready to break fast with some traditional Syrian food.
That looks good.
It's called yabra.
Yummy. What's inside of it?
Rice and meat. And today for the drink, we have one traditional Syrian drink, actually. Like when we were back in Syria, we would go out and buy it about like an hour before the breakfast. And it's kind of plant sweet that you, I don't know if there's a, what would be the, almost licorice, yes. Is that what you said?
Like, Lujain said it first, so.
11-year-old Lujain is helping her mom set the table and counting down the minutes until sunset.
Here.
Two more minutes.
Her younger brother Zaid is sitting across the table, getting ready to eat his serving of yebret and a little cheese pizza he made for himself.
9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Yay.
Yeah, bismillah.
After we break fast and the kids go play Minecraft in the other room, Mayes, Amjad, and I have some time to talk about the bigger questions of being Syrian and Muslim in the United States.
I'm just wondering, like, how you talk to your kids about Syria, like, being immigrants, people who came before, like, you know, what's happening in Syria now, and, like, how you tell your kids about that, you know, like, how does that affect you feeling connected to Syria as a country?
Lujain
had the chance to
live
there. She
had a chance to go with me.
Very short amount of time, but she.
But she had it.
She has some memories.
And she has, when she sees the pictures, so she can remember things. I feel sad more for Zaid because he didn't have the chance to go.
After Lujain was born in 2009, Mayes took her back to Syria to meet the rest of the family. The Syrian civil war started 2 years later, in 2011. Zaid, born at the end of 2012, has never been to Syria.
We don't feel that they can be as safe as we want them to be. I mean, again, you cannot protect them fully, even here in the state or anywhere else. So as long as the ones who are in power now are still in power and nothing is guaranteed.
The increasingly violent conflict in Syria has created waves of Syrian refugees, many of whom begin to arrive in Massachusetts and Rhode Island around 2012. Mayes and Amjad begin to help resettle refugee families through the Muslim Society of Rhode Island, then through the Rhode Island Council for Muslim Advancement, the Syrian American Medical Society, and Americans Helping Others Prosper in Rhode Island. In 2013, when Zaid is still an infant, the fighting in Syria reaches new levels of tragedy.
When the regime has attacked one of the cities with the chemical weapons, and the scenes are still, they're still vivid in my head, the scenes of children suffocating because of the chemical weapons that been used. Sometimes I see my children in those kids. And And you wonder how you feel if it was your child that's in front of you, that is suffocating.
Mays and Amjad have become leaders in both the Muslim Society of Rhode Island and their respective nonprofit efforts. And now they're active members of the Interfaith Coalition in Rhode Island. They bring Lujain and Zaid to rallies against anti-Semitism and Islamophobia. And that's a big part of how the Kinjawis relate to Syria now, because they don't see themselves returning for a long time. I ask Amjad how that affects the way he thinks of his identity.
I'm going to put it in a little funny way.
Okay.
The dates, we put day, month, year, or we can put month, day, year, or we can put year and then month and day. But you still get the same
date.
So I can say I'm a Muslim American Syrian, and I can say I'm a Syrian American Muslim, and I can say American Syrian Muslim. So that's how I identify myself. So you put them in any order you want. It's fine with me.
I have a different perspective because myself, I moved a lot in my life. So I was in Algeria, I was in France, I was in Syria. But in all these times, I guess the only thing that I was always holding with me is my belonging as a Muslim person. It's the only thing that I was holding on it. It's not the country, it's not the space, but it's this thing that is my treasure, that whenever I go, I have it with me, and I wanna invest it in a better way whenever I will be.
الرحمن الرحيم مالك يوم الدين إياك نعبد وإياك نستعين.
It's Sunday, May 24th, Eid al-Fitr, the biggest holiday in Islam. Amjad is standing in his living room, facing east, towards Mecca, leading his family in prayer. Behind him are the line of men, Zaid, Amjad's nephew Sammy, and his brother-in-law Nasser. Behind them, the line of women, Mays, Amjad's sister Reem, Lujain, and her cousin Layla. Amjad placed his phone on the mantle before he started praying so he could record a video to send to me later. We're still social distancing, or else I would have been in North Attleboro with them. And for that reason, Eid, normally a huge celebration of feasts and social gatherings all over the world, has been relegated to immediate families this year. Amjad's sister's family came into town the night before, just in time to break fast.
I mean, the Syrian version. It depends on when I leave, like if it's in the morning.
Are you able to hear us?
Yeah.
I wish that you are here today with us.
In the Kinjawi's dining room, golden balloons float up to the ceiling and crescent moons and stars cascade down the walls. From the corner where the laptop is placed, I can see the table is covered in platters of couscous, kibbeh, and date-filled sweets. Zaid and Lujain argue over the candy and the goodie bags they received from friends earlier in the day. After the meal is over, I'm able to have one last conversation with Mays and Amjad.
How do you guys feel at the end of Ramadan?
I personally cannot believe that it's done.
Me too. But I feel it's the one of the best Ramadan that I had forever. Ramadan comes always with a lot of spirituality. So we feel it every time that Ramadan comes. And we feel sad when Ramadan leaves. And even last time, Zaid, like, he said, I can't believe that Ramadan is going to go over. And he starts crying. A child of 7 years old starts crying because he felt how Ramadan brings us together. Living Ramadan and leaving Ramadan will probably help us more to know exactly what we want after. Especially that we are still in quarantine, especially that nothing changed, but we change inside.
Each Ramadan, you're elevated to a step. So it's almost like a ladder. And each Ramadan is one of the steps on that ladder. And the top of the ladder is where you're
purest, at your finest, and your bestest, as Lujan used to say.
Amjad has to leave to go pray, but Mayiz stays behind and talks to me some more. We've gotten pretty close in the past month of weekly Zoom iftars, texting each other with COVID updates, and learning about each other's lives. She's telling me how she feels lucky to spend this time helping her kids develop their confidence in being Muslim, American, and Syrian.
So we are building two things, the social, the community, and being American, with all the values that Muslim and Islam can bring through our teaching to our kids. It's very helpful to build this personality, to be a new self. And this is one of the things that I focus with my kids in it, because I want them to be proud, happy citizen here. We are American at the end, so no matter what we are here. We are living here and we are doing our job here and we are serving people here, our communities here. So we are part of it.
I'm Ana Gonzalez. Thanks for listening. Mosaic is a production of the Publix Radio, edited by Sally Isley, with production help from Aaron Selbig and James Baumgartner. Our theme music is by Bryn Bliska. Our intern is Michelle Liu. Tori Malatia is the general manager of the Publix Radio. I'm Ana Gonzalez. Thank you so much for listening. If you want to learn more about the stories in Mosaic, visit thepublixradio.org/mosaic. There you'll find other episodes, photographs, videos, and info about how we make Mosaic. As always, you can subscribe to Mosaic wherever you get your podcasts. Support for this podcast comes from the Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and the advancement of international peace and security at carnegie.org.